Hey.
Yay!
I was listening to Shelley, and then all of a sudden I wasn't. That's rude.
Shit happens.
Yeah, it's live TV. That's how you know it's live. You never know what's going to happen. Welcome to the Atheist Experience. We are definitely live. Today's January 19th, 2020. Oh my gosh, that sounds weird to say. I'm living in the future.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm always living in the past. Anyway, I'm hosting today. I'm Matt Dillahunty. Joining me this week, Jenna Bell.
Hello.
And I don't know what episode this is because the whole intro didn't play through, so we didn't see the episode number. I can't. 2403, which makes sense because it's season 24 and we're the third week into the year. 24 seasons, the Atheist Experience has been in various incarnations, and at least 14, if not almost 15 of them, have involved me sitting here.
Wow.
Or sitting wherever we were doing the show.
It's impressive that you're still enjoying it.
It was funny the way you said wow, though. Like, everybody should rewind because she's like,
wow.
Yeah, I can't believe it. What's up with that? How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Spending a lot of time learning and several different, when something comes up several different places, it kind of piques my interest, which I think is a good thing. Since I'm a new skeptic.
But that's how Facebook makes its money. As soon as you see it one time, it starts feeding you more and more and more and more.
Well, but I look different places, like TED Talks, Great Courses, all that kind of thing. And something that's been coming up, even like on NPR and other places, is the talk just talking about insects, eating edible insects. And I know that that's gross. I know that that gives a lot of people like really bad feelings, and I understand that. But I just wanted to throw it out there as something to think about because there's a lot of nutritional benefit to it. You know, there's just so much available. And a lot of places do it. We're actually pretty rare in the fact that it makes us turn up our noses. So
yeah.
I just want people to be
aware. I think the best solution or the best implementation of this I've heard so far is cricket flour.
Yeah.
In that you basically, you grind up cricket stuff and you get protein and you get a protein rich flour, I think. Could be completely wrong. And by the way, if you're a vegan and you're calling in to say that it's no better for us to switch to crickets than it was to chickens, yeah, I don't need to hear it.
I'm not forcing it. I'm not pushing it. I'm just bringing it up as something to think about.
There's lots of stuff like that. There's lots of little things that we can do. But even this isn't about saying, oh, we're going to save the world by switching to plants.
Right.
But maybe you could. Who knows? But at a minimum, if you're the kind of person where it's not like an instant, you know, hey, give it a whirl. I've tried.
Check it out.
I've had bugs.
Yeah.
I've eaten bugs intentionally.
I haven't yet. But I'd be down to try whatever. I actually looked it up and I can't find anything available to us right now in Austin.
Oh, that's baloney.
Well, I mean, I didn't look very hard.
Okay.
But I just browsed trying to see if it was easy to find and it wasn't.
I'd almost be willing to bet. I don't think I have money on me. I have 20 bucks. Yep.
Okay.
I bet there's somebody who can go out and before this show is over, get you and me something like a cricket and a thing of chocolate or something for us to eat before this show's over.
All right.
My treat.
Cool beans.
We'll eat a bug. Just cause. Anything else going? Anything else you've learned? Because we don't need to explore everything you've learned.
No, that's all for now.
Some of it might be, you know, terrifying. Some of it's really interesting. I did a debate last night. We did it actually here. And there were a couple other. It was on Modern Day Debates. And I've posted a link. I know that during the live stream, like 8 minutes in, it cut out for a few minutes or some portion of it. And because of that, he went ahead and set it private. But then when he got the full clip, he posted that this morning. And then I shared it on Patreon and on Facebook and stuff like that. I'm not gonna make excuses. I'm not thrilled with my opening at all because I suffered from insomnia lately and I was half asleep and didn't do a lot of work. So I just jotted down notes based on what I want to talk about. The talking points were fine. Mm-hmm. Talking about when do you have a good reason for something? And it's not just, oh, I'm convinced or, oh, this is the best we've got. It needs to be something more that it rises to. And I think by the time the debate was over, all those points were made much clearer and the rest of the debate was good and I enjoyed it. I'd love to talk with Mike some more. This was Mike Jones in Inspiring Philosophy. And so, yeah, but you go out and think whatever you think. It's just that if you're going to email and say, my God, you were like a meandering idiot zombie during your opening, I know that. I knew that at the time I was uttering those words. But it's all right. We got there.
Yeah.
And you went with me to go buy something to ease my heart. Because I piddle around on guitars and other stringed instruments stuff. I'm not good at all, wouldn't say. But I've always wanted a 12-string. I've never had one. And there was one I kept looking at, and I kept looking at, and I kept looking at. And I was like, kept talking myself out of it. No, you shouldn't spend money on this. You don't play enough. You don't play well enough. And then, you know, the other part of me was like, well, if you get it, you'll play it. You'll play more. And you're, but also, I've got diabetic neuropathy, so my pinkies don't work as well. So I know I'm not going to, so maybe that means time's running out, and I better get it now. And I just decided to do it. And when I went up there, it was on sale.
Yeah.
I was like, okay.
It's a
sign from God that I must buy this 12 string. Yeah. That's
what I would have thought.
once upon a time, I would have thought that too. This sort of view of the universe. And it doesn't have to be a God thing so much, even like karmic views.
Good energy. You
know? Oh, it was on sale today because I was nice to that other person, or I accomplished the things that I needed to do. Mm-hmm. You know, I've put good things out into the universe, and now it's coming. No, it's a bunch of crap. Basically, they didn't sell as many as they thought they were going to sell over the Christmas holidays, and so now they've knocked $100 off of them, which is nice. All right, we have callers waiting. We have loads of callers. Have you glanced through them?
I have.
Have you picked someone that you'd like to start with?
I have.
I knew it.
Well, his name is Christian.
Ah, then Christian from Denmark. Welcome. You're on the show with Jenna and Matt.
Hello.
Hello. Hi, Jenna and Matt. How are you guys doing?
Hi.
Not bad.
Not bad. Okay, good. Listen, I actually been on the show once before. I don't know if you remember me, Matt.
A little bit, yeah.
About antinatalism.
Yeah.
You do?
I remember bits of the discussion, and your voice is familiar.
Yeah, I've never heard of antinatalism. So
I just did a video about it and pissed off a bunch of antinatalists because... So basically somebody sent...
Yeah, and I watched it.
You weren't the one that sent me the email, though, were you?
No.
Okay,
no,
somebody sent me an email and said, hey, I'm having difficulty with this particular argument for antinatalism. That's it. And so I went through and I pointed out all the things that were wrong with the argument and posted it. And I titled the video Answering Antinatalism. And of course they come on and they're like, you're not responding to antinatalism. You're responding to this one version or your straw man interpretation of this one version of this argument. You need to address this argument. And then there were some people who presented what they thought were better arguments. And then there were other people that just called me names. And you know, when it comes to veganism and antinatalism, you're just an idiot who's running away from what you fear and you throw your rationality out the window. And so
I love
I'm going to
people tell me what I'm doing and what my goals are and how I'm feeling. And
it happens all the time. There's a guy who's been repeatedly, sorry, Christian, I'll get to you in just a second, I promise. There's a guy who's been repeatedly emailing nonstop and I wasn't responding. And there were reasons I wasn't responding, but he keeps sending the same thing over and over again. And today I had enough and I let him have it because he is arrogant and rude, and he's, you know, I think your talents are being wasted, and you're not going to fix the world like this, and you might have some local reach, and this might be good for your ego, but you really need to be doing it. And I'm like, dude, just stop.
Yeah, focus on your own life.
So anyway, I'm going to be doing another video about antinatalism that goes into it in greater depth and covers more things, and that's what you wanted to talk about today, so maybe we can hit some of that up today, Christian.
Yeah.
What are you struggling with?
You said in your video, these arguments that you usually antinatalism, and Jenna, you said you've never heard of antinatalism. It's a position where you think it's morally wrong to have kids, but the reason when people argue that people should abstain from having kids because they're going to suffer here, that's also a good argument for antinatalism. However, that's not the main reason why I am an antinatalist.
Right. You had a different one, which is what I wanted to get to.
Yeah, it's because I was brought up as a Christian, and I always feared hell and the afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I my moral won't allow me to have a child if hell is a real place and there's a risk that the child could end up in hell, then I think it would be better never to have been born, because then you're not missing out on good things in life. And if I know that you would say there's no proof that hell exists, but I think the risk of a bad afterlife is well.
I think I know what you're saying.
How should I put it?
It's bad enough to point to real suffering and say that that's enough to that it would be immoral to have kids. I don't agree with that.
Yeah.
But to point to suffering that you don't have any reason to think is real. I mean, you might as well be saying, when I was a kid, I was convinced of the boogeyman and it terrified me. And what if the boogeyman's real and is going to terrify? And what if ghosts are real and they're going to haunt my children forever? What if this is real? You can go through all of these things of, oh, what if this happens? What if this happens? And okay, if that's the case, then you're not going to have kids. And that's fine. That's your choice. You're certainly not doing harm to anyone by not having them.
No.
If there wasn't a hell, would you still have this fear, do you think?
Are you asking if I would be an antinatalist if I wasn't afraid of hell?
Yes.
Maybe. I've never tried not to fear the afterlife, so I don't know. But I would argue that if, let's say that my doctor told me that all my future kids would have terrible diseases, mm-hmm. yes, then I would be an antinatalist. And I would never have kids because it's not me who's going to.
There's a difference, though, between deciding not to have kids and being an antinatalist. One is a choice that you're making for yourself and your life. And the other one is when you're saying it's immoral for anybody to do this.
Yeah.
So which one are you? Do you think it's immoral for yourself or do you think it's immoral for everyone?
I think that if you believe in hell, like I watched this, there was this television program a couple of days ago from the United States. And there was this cult, I think it was called Marlboro Baptist Church or something.
Westboro.
And they said that 99.9% of the world's population will go to hell. And they also thought they might themselves go to hell.
Do you believe them?
I really believe that if you believe what they believe, then you shouldn't have kids because...
I'm convinced that if you sincerely believe what they believe, you shouldn't have kids either because I have no confidence that you're going to raise kids to be rational.
Yeah.
See, that's the thing is you can...
Well...
You can... Go ahead.
Is the goal to have children only to have rational people?
God, I would hope so.
Well, but I wasn't rational until very recently.
You are now, though.
But was I, you know, pointless? Was it not a good thing until I became rational?
No, I'm only talking about if they stay... You know, the people who are perpetually irrational. And that's the thing.
How could you know?
You can't. And that's my point.
Yeah.
I'm not an antinatalist. And I'm not suggesting that anybody shouldn't have kids. And especially not even irrational fundamentalists. That was essentially kind of a joke. But it's not completely a joke because it's about how you're going to raise your kids. And the reason I bring that up is because many of the concerns that people have about what could happen, you know, what if my... Basically, I was asked a question... Is Matt going to be comfortable if his offspring become either the people who enslave someone else or the slaves of somebody else? And I loved that question because it shows everything that's wrong with the way antinatalists are thinking.
Mm.
Because you presented me two options, that either my offspring would become the slavers or would become the enslaved, both of which I would consider bad. There are more options than that. What if they're the people who liberate the slaves? What if they're the people who put an end to slavery? What if they're the people who aren't in either of those categories and are actively working against it? And that's something that we can contribute to. How we raise our kids, what we teach them, does have an impact on who they're likely to become. And so doing the best you can and trying to create the best world, you're not going to eliminate all suffering for everybody.
Right.
But it's already a de facto truth that by and large, for the overwhelming majority of people who've ever lived, suffering didn't outweigh the benefits or the neutrality of life, or they would have ended their lives. I mean, by and large, some people even view suffering and trials as a challenge to get through, where it's difficult at the time. And then when I come through on the other side, I can look back at it and say, ah, yeah, that was a terrible time. I would not want to do that again. And let me see if I can find a way to help other people not have to go through that again. It is not a zero-sum game. It is not a static, fixed way of you can measure, oh, there's X amount of suffering and X amount of pleasure. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes a week of suffering followed by a day of incredible pleasure and release from that, that could be enough to compensate. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes a single day of abject suffering might overwrite all kinds of pleasure. You cannot just simply do that math, and you certainly can't do it for everybody else. And so this is why I'm in favor of, if you don't want to have kids, don't have kids.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm in favor of death with dignity, I think that we have a responsibility to people to keep them from taking the suicide solution to, you know, finite torments that may be treatable, et cetera. But if you're in a position where the continued life is worse than the prospect of death, and there's no realistic hope there, and not necessarily with an individual making this decision, I'm fine with death with dignity. I think people should be allowed to govern their own lives. It's when you start saying that, oh, it's immoral for anybody to have kids because suffering exists. And it is worse, I would say, Christian, in your case, where your reason is not even something about that is necessarily real, like the suffering we know will happen. It's about the possibility of some suffering in it that we don't know about in an afterlife that we can't demonstrate is real.
Yeah. Now you said the suicide solution. That's another thing. One of my colleagues who is a Catholic, he believes that if you commit suicide, you will go to hell.
Okay.
And there's also a reason I think that I don't understand why you have kids.
Because, okay. Here, hang on. I don't believe that if you commit suicide, you go to hell. Why are you prioritizing what your friend believes over what I believe?
Maybe it's because that the risk of if religious people are wrong and there is no afterlife, it doesn't matter, they die and they just
wrong. This is Pascal's Wager. And it is horribly flawed. It was so flawed that it was the first video I did for the Atheist Debates Project. It's like 35 minutes wrong, goes through that. Everything's flawed with it. If, in fact, the religious people who are talking about an afterlife and potential consequences in an afterlife are wrong, then what they've lost is the one and only life they know they're going to get. Their beliefs about an afterlife are impacting how they live this life. And if your fears about an afterlife are impacting whether or not you're willing to have a child, and don't get me wrong, having a child is not right for everybody and you make whatever choice you want. But if it is a fear of something like that that is preventing you from something that could bring you great joy, maybe you would love having a kid, and maybe you would love raising a kid, and maybe you would love teaching this kid about why maybe we don't have any good reason to fear an afterlife. The people who say if they believe they've lost nothing are wrong, because what you believe impacts we know we have this life. We don't know about an afterlife. And so you're risking everything about how you experience and appreciate this life based on what somebody says they believe about some afterlife.
For example, you can have somebody that wants to have kids or could be a really good parent, and then they don't because they're afraid of hell. They're afraid of things that aren't even realistic to consider as reality. And so, I mean...
And while I don't want to go down the idiocracy route, what if the only people who are having kids fall into a category where they're not the type of people that would teach them the problems with this? What if all the people who have rational fears about potential overpopulation or anything else and would actually raise kids to work towards better solutions, what if those are the people that stop having kids? Now, it's a ridiculous, slippery slope thing to get to the movie Idiocracy. But what Jenna said is exactly the same thing. What if somebody who would have been a good parent, who would have raised a kid, how do you know that kid's not going to solve climate change?
I don't.
You don't. And so you put all these things that you don't know. I don't know that whether or not this kid's going to solve climate change or cure cancer or come up with a proof that there is no hell or come up with a proof that there is a hell. And if you could prove that there is a hell, then that would convince a lot of people to potentially live their life differently because now it's real and now there's a real consequence to consider rather than a fictional one. So what the real problem here is for you and for other people who have an antinatalist view and everything else is an absolute abject fear of the unknown. You are amplifying things that you don't know and could potentially go wrong and elevating them to a status over things that you know. How do you know that you're not going to have a kid who fundamentally leaves an incredibly wonderful, productive life that is not only productive and wonderful for them, but is productive and wonderful for other people? You don't know. You could also give birth to a serial killer. You don't know.
How strong is this fear? Like, how often, how much time do you spend thinking about this?
A lot, actually. And
a lot of time?
Do you have a partner who's remotely interested in having kids?
Sorry?
Do you have a partner that is remotely interested and capable of having kids?
No, I'm single.
Well, then okay. I wouldn't worry about it right now.
Well, but just imagine if just take the amount of time that you spend thinking about this to the point that you've come up with the idea of being an antinatalist, even though you don't have a partner, you don't even have that on the table as an option right now. But you think about it enough to come up to that conclusion. What do you think you could do with that time if you didn't have that fear? Do you think, what if you filled it with gratitude? What if you filled it with education? What if you filled it with other things? Because it sounds to me like you spend a lot of time being afraid.
Yeah, and it's maybe it's because I was 5 or 6 or something, I asked my mom. I was brought up as a Christian, and I asked my mom if there was anything that God would not forgive, and she said that everything should be forgiven except blasphemy against the Holy Spirit. But when I asked her what that meant, she couldn't tell me because she didn't know. Mm-hmm. So, you have to remember, I was quite little, and mm-hmm. and I actually spent years being afraid of, you know, unknowingly doing it because I didn't know what to stay away from.
Dude, we get it.
So maybe. I have always, I mean, my two brothers, they are both atheists, and my dad is atheist, but my mom is not. And me and my mom, we have always been the religious in our family. So maybe it's something from childhood. I don't know.
Do you talk to your atheist family members about anything like this?
Yes. They use the same arguments as you guys. Why would I believe it when there's no proof?
Yeah, it's
no
worse than that.
To believe.
So have you asked God what it means to blaspheme the Holy Spirit?
No.
Why haven't you asked God?
Why
haven't you asked God?
I don't think he answered me. He will.
Okay.
Why not?
Well,
if he's going to judge you and there's one unforgivable sin and you're not clear on what it is.
And he can't clarify it.
And you ask God and you think he's not going to answer. Does he not care? Does he not love you? Does he not want you to know and understand?
What if he's not there?
No, I think, well, my colleague who's a Catholic I mentioned earlier, I asked him if he knows what it means. And he believes it is...
I don't care what he believes in. You shouldn't either. What does God say it is? Because if your Catholic friend tells you the wrong thing, you're screwed. If your mom tells you the wrong thing, you're screwed. If you come to the wrong conclusion on your own, you're screwed. It's God's responsibility to answer this question. Why do you think he wouldn't answer?
Because I don't think he speaks. I mean, if you're hearing God's voice in your head, it's probably because you're mentally ill or something. I don't know.
Okay, so how does anybody know what God wants, and how did anybody ever write down in the Bible that the one unforgivable sin is blasphemy against the Holy Spirit? That was a man, a person that wrote it, right?
Yeah.
And if God didn't talk to them, how do they know what God wants?
Yeah, he said that if you can't hear it, then you must be mentally ill.
But no, if you do hear God's voice, you're mentally ill.
Oh, if you do hear God, you must be mentally ill? Oh. Yeah.
Maybe I should... clarify that. I mean, if you're hearing voices in your head, it's probably because I don't think it's because God actually speaks to you.
How did you reach that conclusion? How did you determine that God can't speak to you in a voice that you can hear? Is God too weak to do that?
I thought he could do anything? What can he do? If he can't speak, he can't let you know what he wants you to do. What can he do? What, I mean, what's the point of him?
Maybe it's more in that he doesn't interfere with the physical.
No. You're essentially saying that God has one unforgivable sin, and if you do it, God will definitely send you to hell. And yet, you're saying that God doesn't speak to people, and that God won't answer you when you ask him what that one unforgivable sin is. So how is it possible for a moral being to judge you on a criteria and not explain to you what that criteria is? If I had a rule and you came into my house and I had a list of rules, you know, take your shoes off, use the plastic plates instead of the glass plates, and don't for bubble lids, because that will get you kicked out of the house and shot in the backyard as an invader. Now, do you know what that even means? Kerfubble buzz? Nobody does. I just made it up. Now, if you don't know what it is, how could it possibly be reasonable? I mean, granted, it's never going to be reasonable for me to take you out in the backyard and shoot you, which I think is the same as true for God. But it's even worse if I said, how dare you do this? This is an insult to me. How dare you do this thing? And I never explained what it is. And when you ask me, I don't answer you.
And you only talk to mentally ill people.
The responsibility for all of this, if God is the judge and the rule maker, the responsibility for the clarity and understanding of the rules is on the judge who's making this decision and making the rules. Furthermore, it's worse in the case of a God, because God also created you and gave you a brain and did not make your brain capable of understanding this. God is the worst communicator in all of history. And I think that it's more plausible that it's because he doesn't exist, and what we have are what men think about a God, whether he exists or not. And under your model, if God doesn't speak to people, then you're agreeing with me that the only things we know about God are what people think, and not what anybody knows, and not anything that God has ever demonstrated. So why would we believe one God over another if it's just what people think?
I'm really, really doing my best to.
No, you are. You're good. You're good.
I'm really doing my best to be rational, but like this, the antinatalist position, because the risk of hell. There's another one of my colleagues who's a Muslim, and we were talking about this, and I said that I wouldn't have a child because the risk of hell, and he said that I'm not supposed to think like that because God would condemn me.
And then, it's just one other person's opinion.
Why does that opinion matter? I mean, at least in your case, here's your solution. I will use your own religion on your behalf. Do you believe that the Bible is an accurate model of what God wants?
I'm not. When I said that I am religious in some way, I'm not following any book. It's not like that I know the Bible.
No. If you say that the only unforgivable sin is blasphemy of the Holy Spirit, that comes straight out of the Bible, or straight out of somebody's ass.
Or from his mom.
Yeah, but that was my mom. My mom told me that.
Okay, but does your mom believe in the Bible?
She believes that in God and Jesus.
Christian, so where are you getting that? You're literally just asking people randomly, asking your mom here, asking a coworker here, asking a talk show host here. You're just asking people randomly and just kind of, are you kind of guessing?
Guessing about what?
A God.
About any gods. Are you just kind of guessing with what feels right? How are you coming to these conclusions that there's this one rule and that you can't break that rule? Like, are you just taking random people's words for it and just, are you guessing?
No, my mom is not a random person.
No. Does God talk to your mom?
Sorry?
Does God talk to your mom?
No.
How does your mom know anything about God?
Or your coworker, or anybody else you've talked to about anything that you've taken on as fact?
The Catholic coworker, he reads a lot in the Bible.
And your Muslim friend reads a lot from the Quran, and you're going to find a Scientologist soon who's going to have a view. But the point is, you're running around asking people, do you have any good reason to think that any of these people have any expertise in the subject, or that their answer is likely to be correct?
No, not these people, but...
So then why?
Is there anybody who's likely to be correct about this?
Actually, one of my uncles claims to have some kind of...
I no longer give a shit.
I'm sorry, Christian.
I genuinely no longer give a shit. This is really easy. Is there, you think one of your uncles, out of everybody who's ever lived and everybody who's alive, has an expertise?
But he didn't come up until now. He wasn't important enough to talk about.
Yeah, he wasn't important enough to list first. But you've got an uncle.
Yeah, I have an uncle.
What's your uncle's expertise in God, and how did he get it?
My aunt claims that he has some kind of healing powers.
Hold on.
I'm not going to hang up. You can do it.
Hold on. This is like your post-it note on the fridge.
Yeah.
Thing. Can you do that, or do you want me to try?
I think I've done 10 different versions of it already in this.
That's true.
So your aunt claims that your uncle has healing powers. First of all, why the hell would we believe your aunt? Why would you believe your aunt? Have you bothered to test whether or not your uncle has healing powers? And what the hell does your uncle's healing powers, even if they existed, have to do with any God or any expertise on God?
Yeah, actually, I'm really trying to be rational. Like, I keep questioning myself.
Do you know what rationality is?
Yeah.
What is it?
It's when there's good reason to believe something.
What defines whether or not there is a good?
Yeah, but
how would you know? Like, what is rationality? Oh, wait.
When there's good reason to believe in something.
Okay. Do you have a good reason to believe that your uncle has healing powers?
No.
Okay. Then why the hell did it come up? Do you have good reason to believe that your uncle has any expertise on God?
No.
Do you have any good reason to believe that anybody has expertise on God?
No.
Okay.
No. So maybe watch this clip over and call back.
Yeah, okay.
Okay? No, you're awesome. Yeah, you've been really honest, and we really appreciate you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, where are we going next?
Kayla.
Oh. Hey, Kayla.
Hello.
How
Hi,
you
Kayla.
Doing?
Hi. I'm good. How are you?
Looks like you've got something exciting to talk about.
You have an update for us.
I do. So, Matt, I spoke with you like 6 months ago. I doubt you recall, but I was getting married to an atheist.
Yeah.
And I was calling in regarding to a wedding we were planning, and you guys suggested a humanist celebrant, and we were going to look into that. Well, since then, I have decided to stop lying and let go of me trying to pretend to be a religious person when I don't really buy any of it. I just like it, but it makes me feel good.
Woo!
Thank you.
Yay!
And by the way, you got there way faster than I did and way faster than a lot of other people yeah. have. Well, congratulations. How was the wedding?
So the wedding hasn't happened yet.
Okay.
We're still getting married, and he's still an atheist, so I guess I'm still marrying an atheist, except now there's no point.
Now you're not going to be unequally yoked.
Yes, exactly. So I don't remember if I told you guys this last time or not, but I was born and raised in Georgia. Mm-hmm. My family is very conservative. They're all super religious. My uncle is like a Calvinist who lives in the woods somewhere and already harasses me for dating an atheist. They don't know yet. None of them know, but they're funding and planning the entire wedding.
Oh,
So we kind of already had broke the news that we were planning a humanist celebrant, that me and my fiance would pick that out, and that we would be kind of planning the ceremony stuff. We have considered breaking the news to them early so that they don't find out and freak out. We set a date for late August.
Okay. On the one hand, the fact that you told them that you're going to have a humanist celebrant, I think if other people are paying for something, it should be made clear to them. I mean, they're going to be shocked no matter what. But to say we're having a non-religious ceremony and event, that much they should know if they're paying.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, they already know that.
All right. Okay, good. Because you're like, the way it came out, and Jenna and I are looking at each other, it's like, yeah, they're all paying for it, and they don't know yet. And I was like, that's going to be a fucking awesome wedding.
No, they know about the humanist celebrant because Sean's my fiance, sorry. He's been openly atheist since he was like 18. So
sure.
When we were dating, he was atheist. So they knew that the wedding would be largely non-religious.
Okay, perfect.
for his religious beliefs. So we're thinking that it they may not notice, you know, denying the reality and ignoring it is what my family does very well.
Mm-hmm. I learned it from them. I know what you're talking about.
Bless their hearts.
So they may, you know, do us all a favor and pretend not to notice anything until after the wedding.
Probably.
You might be surprised. So
yeah,
my uncle,
kind of the, oh,
my uncle came to my wedding. And of course, everybody knew we were atheists, and we had a completely Aaron Ra performed the ceremony, and we didn't have it at a church. It was at an outdoor venue and everything else. And I had plenty of religious friends and religious family members who came to the wedding, and they all enjoyed it and had a good time. It was nothing shocking because they already knew we were a bunch of godless heathens. And so I think they were just glad that there weren't, like, you know, strippers and child sacrifices at the reception. But my uncle came up and talked to me very briefly afterwards because he wanted to know where we got the words that we put into our ceremony and our vows and all of that stuff. And because he was saying that seemed like a very secular humanist, you know, thing. And I was like, yeah, you know, we went and we took some stuff from Greta and Ingrid's wedding, bits and pieces that we liked out of theirs. We took some out of another friend's and some out of some recommendations from secular humanists. And then we sat down and wrote some of our own stuff. And then we published it all. As a matter of fact, it's probably on my Facebook somewhere.
Cool.
The vows and stuff. Those things will be online longer than I was married. but it's really nobody, I mean, everybody enjoyed themselves. And one of my favorite moments from the reception is Don Baker, who's my other co-host on here, his husband, Elton, they weren't, I think they got married after us, or maybe just before us. It was all around the same time, like three sets of people got married. Anyway, so they come to the wedding, and we're at the reception, and people are out there dancing. And I noticed that Don and Elton weren't dancing. And I know Don well enough to know that he would have had fun out there dancing with his husband. And I walk over to Don, and I said, hey, just so you know, if you guys aren't dancing because you're worried about offending, you know, religious people in my family or whatever else, fuck them. I paid for this, and you're my friends, and you're my family, and you should get out there and dance. And in the signs from God category, not only did ABBA's Dancing Queen start playing exactly then, but my dad and Beth's dad were dancing together out on the floor to Dancing Queen as sort of a joke. You know, look, we're so manly, we can act gay. And I was like, get your husband out there. It was fun.
That does sound fun. So, but my major two concerns, which are things I've largely been preparing myself for a long time before I really admitted the truth, but when I called in last time, I kind of mentioned I have obsessive compulsive disorder, and sometimes it picks up on things and makes them crazy. It has done that with hell. So I want to be as prepared as possible for when my family does find out. They already don't know that I'm not entirely straight. They're just very not nice. And so that's already going to be rough. But they're also going to blame my fiance because I was, even though I had been considering my beliefs for a long time, I was not open about that with anyone except for him. So to their knowledge, I was, you know, the best Christian in the world. And then I met John and he dragged me into hell with him.
I had the same experience.
Those are going
to
be.
It happened to Beth as well.
Yeah.
Beth was actually an atheist before I was, because she kind of got rid of it around 15 or so, but kept it hidden and even did vacation Bible school. And so when her family found out that she was dating me and I was an atheist, they blamed me for that. And I was 100% fine with that, because if they're focused their anger and stuff on me and she looks more like a victim, at least they're not being as mean to her in this process, and let them blame me all day long while they work through it. And eventually, when they finally met me after trash talking me and proving that they were worse people than I was, they came to like me and we all got along. It's not surprising. And now I don't think anybody blames me for Beth because they know the truth.
Well, the thing is that you may find out that you have family members. Like, for example, I came out probably in the wrong way. I came out very, very quickly and on Facebook. I was trying to just get it all done before Thanksgiving a little over a year ago. And so I thought that would be easiest. But what I probably should have done is just hang out with people at just naturally and just as it comes up, discuss it then. But I don't think that it's something that I should have had felt like I had to advertise. I just felt like I was being dishonest by not saying something because it was so obvious and I was so open about my Catholicism before that I almost felt like I was hiding behind that by not saying something. But in the good, on the good side, I had several people reach out to me that I don't know how to describe it. It's like you think that they're all one group and you think that they're all thinking the same way, but then after you kind of pull back and say, hey, I'm an atheist. I'm not fully in this group anymore. A couple people will reach out and be like, hey, by the way, I'm on your side too, at least a little bit, and I'm here for you. And those relationships are becoming so much stronger than the few relationships I had amongst that whole group. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple closeted atheists in my family.
Yeah, no one is openly atheist in my family.
Right.
The first atheist most of my family met was Sean, and they asked me how I could want to be with the devil. And I was like, he's an atheist. And they were like, yes, they worship the devil. And I'm like, I think you're really confused. I'm the devil.
Yeah.
So they had problems with that. And I, you did when I came out as bisexual, where I kind of like made a big deal. Everyone was like, everyone needs to know right now. It did not go over well. It was kind of all the heat at once. Right. And it was weird. People were like, okay, like, I don't care. Mm-hmm. Why are you, you know? Mm-hmm. So I kind of had said that, and with Sean's advice, to kind of let this come out naturally.
Yeah. And that can also work in your favor, too. Because now they're going to be sitting there, well, at least she's marrying a man.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, we're still like one step closer. But I also think maybe.
Hello?
And they imagine that this is following.
Can you repeat
your
that?
Your phone's cut out a couple times, and so we missed the last thing you said.
Oh, sorry. I hope that they are suspecting that this is following, you know, because they always are really strong supporters of.
Even if they weren't suspecting it, they'll pretend that they were suspecting it.
Yeah, well, that's fine. So the major thing is just preparing for when they do find out and the kind of position it puts us in now, planning a wedding, and people are asking, okay, like, what, you know, when do you want to do the prayer?
Like, so I'm not always the best. Like, when I get volunteers up on stage and I'll do like fake readings, I might do one after the show's over because there's a new trick that I'm putting in the show that I'd like to practice. But I do get a good feel from people. You seem kind of sassy to me, Kayla.
I'm a little.
Yeah. I would think that probably the thing that's in your best interest is to just own that. And rather than making any kind of big deal about it, hey, this is the man. This is the man that I'm marrying. This is the man that I love. Here's what I think. Here's what I don't think. It's none of y'all's damn business. And I'm going to live my life. And I still love you and care about you. And if you want to cut me out because you're bigots or whatever, I mean, you don't have to say all of this, but I think you'll be able to say it without saying it. In just, I'm going to be me and love my life. And I would like to keep you people in it, but I have no time and no spoons. Ain't nobody got time for religious bigots who are going to try and shut me down or shut my new husband down.
Mm-hmm. I'm majorly concerned about, well, I'm already estranged from the majority of my family because they already think I'm going to hell for dating an atheist. But I'm extremely concerned about when people I care about, you know, I listened to you talk about your parents, yeah, on your birthday or something. I heard a story.
Yeah.
When the people that I care about are coming to me like, hey, I'm really sad that you're going to burn in hell for eternity.
I'm really sad that
you
think that.
You know what you should say? I'm not.
It's something that I told an entire Baptist church when Mike Lacona and I were debating the resurrection, is that I understand that I have relatives who are incredibly sad because they're convinced that I'm going to burn in hell and that I am leading people to Satan and that this makes them look at me either with fear, anger, or pity. And the fact that they believe this and that it makes them look at me with fear, anger, or pity and impacts our relationship makes me sad too.
Mm-hmm.
Because from their point of view, I've bought into a lie and it's really bad. And from my point of view, they've bought into a lie and it's really bad. I get it.
So then you can say, hey, now what can we do from here? Can we suck it up and have a relationship without all this nonsense? And just, can we have a relationship without religion? And if you can't, that sucks.
Yep. But what I'm saying is, I like your sass. Nice sass.
Thanks.
No, that type of thing, the type of personality that you have, can actually work things. You've already done one thing, which is, you know, coming out as bi and dealt with potential consequences from that. Are they talking about you behind your back? Probably. Are they talking with each other about what their fears and concerns are? Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably. You got your life, and now you're starting it off with somebody else, and it sounds like, for the most part, you're ready and let the chips fall where they may, and I think you're going to end up all right. And the big thing to know is that they didn't change the nature of this relationship. Something about you has changed. That doesn't make this your fault, but it makes it your responsibility to own that at the beginning. If the change in you puts them in a position where now they have to change the nature of the relationship, that is on them mm-hmm. and their religious beliefs. And if you just let people know that, you know, hey, I still care about you. I mean, my folks and I get along. We talk all the time, tell each other we love each other because we do. Doesn't mean that there hasn't been some absolutely awful bullshit on occasion. But, you know, mm-hmm. you got to figure out what you're going to put up with. And I think you're already on the right track.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so, too. And Sean's been a really big help.
Oh, good. Yeah, so. You have him, too. So that's...
If he hasn't been, you should cancel the wedding.
For sure.
Because if he's not a big help now, I don't think he's going to get to be a better help later.
Thanks for calling, Kayla.
He kind of said the same thing. Yeah, no problem. He kind of said the same thing about that Matt had said about, like, if they're mad at me, that's fine, because at least they're not mad at you. So,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, well, thank you, guys. I appreciate y'all.
Absolutely. Thanks for checking back in, Kayla. Appreciate it. All right. Well, you know, 6 months... Somebody has a conversation and now they're an atheist and they're getting married. Woohoo!
So funny, like how much people care about what you're doing, not necessarily how you're feeling, but what you're doing. Like I had a family member right after I came out that went up to another family member of mine that they're not really close to and was like, "Hey, we got to go get Jenna. We got to get together. We got to get her drunk because, you know, then she'll be a little more open-minded and we got to get together she's really messing up. We got to help her out, man. You want to get an alcoholic drunk to try to get her to believe in a God again? Like, I would never do that to you."
To be fair, my parents would never suggest getting me drunk to bring me back to God.
It wasn't my parents, but it was a family member.
I don't think anybody in my family would do that. So that's rather weird. And actually, because of the alcoholism, that makes it, it's like that became the target as well.
We can do it. This is how we can get in her mind is if she, you know. She
by the way, buzzed. For anybody who missed it, Jenna hit me. I hit her back. See how that works? No. Where are we going next? Who are we going to talk to?
Alan
on line 6 in sunny California. I hope it's sunny. Maybe it's not. How you doing, Alan? You're on with Jenna and Matt.
Hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Not too bad.
So, good, good. Well, as you probably saw, I think I figured out one of the reasons why I seem to not be able to let go of my belief in God.
Okay.
And I think it's because, and I'm not asking for empathy, but I suffer from borderline personality disorder.
Okay.
So my judgment isn't always the best. And there's been several times where I should have either been killed or I should have been in trouble and things intervened. And at first I would initially get mad, like, why can't I just be in charge of my own fate? Mm. But then I think to myself, maybe it's God, maybe it's not. But still, I don't buy into the Bible at all. And part of me is like, dude, this is irrational. But I think because I have borderline personality disorder and my judgment is poor and I've experienced a lot of failures, I'm not so much more so afraid of going to hell. I'm afraid of not having a guide to intervene at the last minute when I mess up.
Do you think that you have a guide that would intervene at the last minute?
I'll be honest, I'm not 100% convinced at all. You got me there.
Yeah, I mean, so if you don't have a good reason to think you have one, then you don't have a good reason to think you'd be losing one. And this is not relevant to the show. This is entirely personal. Can I ask you a rather strange question about your condition?
I understand, sure.
One, I don't know whether or not you're being treated, but do you have periods where you completely shut down, like are catatonic and don't want to interact with people?
No.
Okay.
Oh, dissociate? I am pretty antisocial.
You mean dissociate or do you mean?
No, we don't need to go into it. It's not relevant here. It's just, it's a thing. So anyway, on the actual subject, if you're sitting here saying, hey, I don't believe the Bible, and I'm not sure if I believe this other stuff, I'm just terrified of the potential consequences of my own decision. And it'd be really nice to think that there was somebody there who was going to rescue me right before I did something that was too bad. Yeah, that'd be really nice. Who wouldn't want, hey, you're getting ready to really screw up. Let me step in and help out.
You know how you find that?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm listening.
You build a community around yourself that you have people that you trust their judgment, and you can say, hey, check me when I do this. Check me when I do that. If I'm saying something that's wrong, let me know. Build yourself a community that can help you do that. Mm. Sorry to cut you off.
No, that's exactly where I was going. I don't have any reason to think that there's a guardian angel, but I do have friends. Mm-hmm. And the more I shut myself off from friends, the less capable they are to say, hey, you're fucking up. It's difficult. And what it means is that sometimes even when you don't feel like it, it's probably in your best interest to find some people and to build that network with just, it doesn't have to be massive. Mm-mm. Probably shouldn't just be one. It probably should be two or three people that you can find that you can trust with stuff to say, hey. And especially if you know that there are areas where your decision-making is flawed. Mm-hmm. In the same way, if you're dealing with somebody who's an alcoholic but who's actually struggling with it, hey, I know that when it comes to these kind of decisions, I'm going to probably screw up or I'm a bigger risk. Can you let me know if you start to see that? And so if Jenna had come to me with something like that, and let's say the whole ACA was getting ready to go out to a bar and hang out, if I thought for a second that would be problematic for her, then as a friend, I would say, hey, do you really want to do this? Or better, I would say, can we move this someplace so that Jenna can go with us? Now, as it turns out, I don't have any reason to suspect that is a problem because you're fairly well grounded and you haven't told me.
Well, I don't go to bars.
Yeah. You haven't told me, hey, here's an area where I want you specifically to do that. But you have networks of people that you do that with. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to give people the impression that
I do.
I'm not necessarily part of Jenna's network. We're friends and we're on the show together. But yeah, building that. Build your own guardian angels. And rather than relying on a possible fictional one, mm-hmm. now all of a sudden you don't have to hang on to any religious baggage and you have something that is demonstrably real to help you instead of something that maybe doesn't exist.
Yeah, that makes plenty of sense. And I appreciate it. That gives me a lot to think about.
Good.
I guess another reason... Another reason why I can't seem to let it go, and this is totally childish and selfish of me, and it may make me sound like a monster. I think another reason, and other people don't seem to talk about this, I think another reason why so many of us want to cling on to this belief is because, let's be honest, most people would like the idea of being God, being in charge of every aspect of their life. And the only thing closest to that is to, quote unquote, have a relationship with that being. But I guess that's more so for my insecurity than more so belief.
Kind of depends on what your God model is. I would have never looked at it. That basically, the type of Christianity that I was particularly raised in, it's not like it makes me any closer to being a God. It's because God ultimately has his plan and he's going to do what he wants to do. And he's got made his decisions about my life and everything else. It's not like I'm, you know, maybe Mormonism where, you know, when you're done, you get to be your own God with your own planet type thing. Yeah.
So which religion are you coming from?
I come from a non-denominational Christian background here in California. And what I mean by being my own God isn't necessarily like, oh, I'm going to be divine and I have people worshiping. Nah, that sounds terrible. Ugh. What I mean is not having to worry about anything anymore.
Yeah.
And it's childish. I know, but that's what I mean. I
try not to use childish as a pejorative anymore because what it is it's human. And while we look at some things and say, oh, this is immature, okay, so what? Label childish, immature, whatever else. My concern is it reasonable? Is it rational? And is it something that's productive that's going to lead you towards something better? You disagree.
Well, I wouldn't say it's childish. I'd say it's human.
That's what I just said.
Well, but the reason I try to clarify that is because, like, when they say let go, let God— You know, like you say that we want to just be able to not worry about it. Like, I think that there's good behind that. There's you know, to be able to let go and not be worried about everything all the time is the only way you can make it to tomorrow.
Mm. Yeah, well.
Like, I just mean that there's a balance. There are things to worry about. There are things to let go. The let go, let God is because we are human and we are naturally wired to stress. And so it's good to have something on the outside of us telling us stop that for a little bit because you're obsessing.
I just realized I don't have my little soundboard push button out here. And it doesn't matter because it doesn't. I would love for it to have like the let it go from Frozen.
I like what you brought up, Jenna. Let go, let God intervene. Well, growing up, I was hearing like people say, oh, let God handle it all. And my question would be, how come God lets bad things happen?
Right.
Well, you can't expect God to do all the work. I'm like, are you fucking kidding? French.
Yeah.
Well, it's like, you know, just do the best you can, and then what happens will happen.
That
and
wasn't
then...
French, by the way. It would be le fuck.
Yeah. I think you're doing all right, Alan.
All right. Well, thank you both. And even though I'm at this point, I'm still an agnostic person, I do appreciate what you guys do with the Atheist Community of Boston because I am staunch on separation of church and state, and you guys seem to be the ones that do that. So thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This community.
Keep thinking. Keep calling. Right.
Yeah, maybe not quite as much on like AXP calls. We don't get into as much church separation as perhaps we should or would like to. But
you might like to call Truth Wanted. They haven't a lot of time to talk and break things down.
But, you know, outside of this, I tend to do a lot of work with other organizations when I can on church state separation issues. Mm. And, you know, American Atheist does it. Freedom from Religion Foundation does it.
And we just started GB3 again. So we're talking about that kind of thing. Yay.
All right.
All right.
We got Corey. Is that where we're going?
Yeah.
Hey, Corey, you're on with Jenna and Matt. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Hello.
I'm told that you wanted to talk about biblical slavery.
Well, yeah, I know that you reference Exodus 21 a lot, correct?
Among other things, but yeah, that's probably the go-to.
Yeah, can I share two quick Bible verses with you?
Sure.
Okay, Psalm 24:1, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. The world and all its people belong to him. Psalm 115:3, our God is in the heavens and he does whatever he wishes.
Yep.
So does God have the right to endorse slavery or institute it?
Does he think he does?
No, does he have the right to?
No, he doesn't. Well, I can't stop him from endorsing slavery. The question is it right to, not whether or not someone has a right to endorse slavery, is whether or not it is right, morally right, to endorse slavery. Simply saying that, okay, hey, the Bible endorses slavery, and somewhere else in the Bible it says that everything belongs to God, so he gets to do whatever he wants. I don't give a shit. The fact that everything...
Well, you don't have to.
You know, even if every... Well, the point is that it doesn't change whether or not it's moral. If you are God and everything is yours and belongs to you, does that mean that there's no moral consequences to how you decide to treat the things that are yours?
Well, I mean, that's really irrelevant. He didn't consult me when he instituted slavery, and maybe you're pissed because he didn't consult you either. I don't know.
I am pissed that he didn't consult me. He's never consulted me, and the words that are being represented on his behalf show that he is demonstrably immoral and less moral and has less moral understanding than I did. So maybe if he'd have called me and consulted me, we could have sorted this shit out rather than having a book endorse immorality for thousands of years, polluting the minds of countless people.
So, all right. So you're morally perfect, right?
No, but what? I'm morally superior to the God in the Bible.
Well, I'm glad you think so.
I'm right.
Okay, so hey, are you going to just bring sarcasm in here or are you going to have a fucking conversation? Corey?
You're right.
Corey?
If Corey, you're right, I can't argue with you, right?
No, we can argue. Here's the thing.
No, there's nothing to argue about. You're right. You're God, right?
Dude.
I didn't say I was God, Corey. God.
Dude, I'm done with
you're
him.
You're putting yourself in the place of a God.
That's yes, I am, Corey. And wouldn't you prefer me as a God? Would you prefer?
About then.
Corey?
What?
Would you prefer me as a God being opposed to slavery or someone else as a God saying slavery's okay? Which would you prefer?
You're not God, so it don't matter.
Are you going to answer my question?
No, I'm not.
You know why you're not? Because you're fucking afraid of the answer. That's why?
No.
You know that you would rather have me as a God.
It's hypothetical. You're not God.
I didn't say I was God. I said I'm better than your God.
You're implying that you are.
No, I'm not. I haven't remotely implied that I'm God, Corey. I've said I'm better than God. Bye.
I think he's right. I think you're right.
Corey hung up on his own.
Well, poor guy. Poor guy.
That's my job. How dare you take my job of hanging up on you, Corey? Do you think you're God or something? Do you get to hang up on yourself, Corey? I don't care. You must think you're God. No, I just think your God sucks.
Yeah. Sorry.
Absolutely ridiculous. Anyway, we've got David in Kentucky is on with Jenna and Matt. How are you? Are you God? David? Whoops.
David?
Hello?
Hi.
Hey.
Hi. Oh, I'm sorry. I was on hold for a very long time, and glad I'm on. Big fan, you guys. No, I'm not God.
Well, that's disappointing, because you could have cleared up this shit between me and Corey.
Well, my grandfather told me you can't argue with ignorance, so it's best to step aside. So,
but your grandfather was wrong because you can educate ignorance and then you can have the argument. But anyway.
Okay. I've got nothing against that.
I'm God. You can't argue with me. I'm better than God. Anyway, what have you got for us, David? I apologize for letting the last call spill over into yours.
Oh, no, it's not an issue. It's not an issue. So my call is in regards to a caller you had a while back. It was over... there was a brain dead woman, and she had a child inside of her, and they pulled the plug. And essentially, the caller was trying to argue the basis of who are we to make that call and things of that nature.
Depends on who's making the call, because so I'm in favor of individuals' autonomy and sovereignty over their own body. But if someone has been designated by that person as the person to make that decision, then okay, cool. Like I guess I need to redo it now because for the record, despite the fact that we are divorced, Beth is still my go-to. And if I wind up in a position and Beth says, pull the fucking plug, pull it.
I mean, sure. I completely agree. If I'm in a vegetative state, and
I just wanted it on record because I don't have it written down somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. If I'm in a vegetated state, my wife is fully aware that, the quality of life is none. And, I would want the same thing.
The reason I'm still fine, and first of all, Beth and I are still friends and we still talk and I still trust her judgment on that stuff. But the reason that she's the one is because I know that she will follow the science and listen to the medical experts and talk about whether or not what are the chances of recovery and what's my quality of life after that and all of that. And I know that she will make a reasonable decision.
Yeah, based on the evidence that's provided, of course.
Yeah, and comparing that to what she knows of my desire, there are very few people who know what I would want probably much more than. There are some who know more than her, but not really much.
Yeah, absolutely. But
so what was the question? Because we got kind of distracted. It was about a call that came in, and you had a follow-up question to that.
Yeah, well, I wanted clarity on what you would consider to be life. And if you yourself find life to be precious, in the regards of what we have here on Earth, carbon-based life and things like that, there's probably discoveries out there that we haven't made yet. There could be organisms made of pure energy that we wouldn't perceive as alive by our standards here on Earth. However,
well, there's a lot of different usages. There's a lot of different usages of the word life. Plants are alive. Sure. And so then we get into issues of, are plants conscious? Well, according to last night's debate, maybe they are. Are plants sentient? I don't see any reason for that. But the bigger question is one that you asked, which I'm getting ready to address in a video probably next week as well, which is life precious? To whom?
I think the question is human life precious?
That is... No. All life. Okay. So for me, personally, I don't put humans on a platform above any other organism.
I do.
Any other? Because any?
So there's a baby and a cricket, and each one of them's under the wheel of a car, and the car's getting ready to back over one of them. Which one do you save?
Now, that is more of a philosophical question rather than a moral, question.
That's a load of shit. First of all, it's an easy question.
Okay, it's easy for you.
But it's absolutely...
It's not easy for you?
People have different beliefs.
So if this car was about to go over this baby, you don't have a lot of time to call us and talk about it first. You have a second to go. What are you doing? Are you saving the cricket, saving the baby, or leaving them both?
Well, of course I would save the child because it has more...
Of course you would.
Cool.
Which is why I asked a question that didn't need somebody to say that's more of a philosophical question than a moral question when it's absolutely a moral question and a philosophical question and a dirt easy question. And the point of asking that easy question is because, yes, in fact, we do, almost all of us, actually value humans more than others. Life
Yeah, because we're socialized animals, and that's how we are structured.
Sure, just like, because we're going to be able to empathize with that which is closer to us than we are with something that's far from us. But the question that I would, like in a recent debate, there were people who were frustrated because I said that humans don't have intrinsic value. Now, there's a difference between intrinsic value and inherent value, and I'll be talking about that in the coming week, because do they have inherent value? Yes. Nothing has intrinsic value. Value requires a valuer. It is an assessment of, do you care about this? And so it's going to be subjective. But talking about whether or not we should act as if people have value, yes. And do people have value to me personally? You betcha. I have loads of value to me, almost infinite value to me. I have to myself. Then the people that I care about, I care more about Jenna. Sorry, David, than I do about you currently. That could change.
Absolutely.
And so this is natural. Now, when you start talking about that, people are like, "Oh, that's a dangerous thing to say that people don't have intrinsic value, because now all of a sudden it's all just subjective and people can value whatever they want." Yes, because people can be wrong. Because people can have an assessment that is wrong. But by and large, it's like if you drew a line of things that you value, and right here, here's the middle, and I'm over here. All of humanity is way up in this upper teeny percentile of things that I give a shit about. And then maybe it extends to the other primates and dolphins and things like that. Maybe, no, you shouldn't do this. You shouldn't do this, Matt. You shouldn't. It's the truth. I'm sorry that some people can't handle the truth, but this is why I do the cricket baby thing.
Sure, but
I'm not saying you're saying
if
that.
If I take that, no. If I take that, I'm an environmental science major. I've taken biology and botany and mycology as well.
Well, even from a practical matter, you would want to save the baby and not the cricket. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Let me reverse the question. So let's say it's the exact same scenario. Okay, it's a baby, and instead of just one cricket, we'll give it two, a male and a female
cricket. Put a thousand there.
Those are the last of those crickets on the entire world. That's the last of that species.
Yep.
And you have a chance to completely save that species. That baby is one of billions.
Yep. And it may grow up to be a serial killer.
It may grow up to find more crickets.
And I'm still saving the baby.
Yeah, but one thing that we learned in environmental science and other classes like that is there are certain species in the world that are known as keystone species, without which the entire ecosystem that's based around them would completely crumble. The mosquito is a prime example. A lot of people say, let's get rid of the mosquito because, it's the number one killer of
see,
all
see,
time.
You're spinning this in a different direction, which is about intentionally exterminating based on evidence. I'm just talking about value.
Yeah, and so am I. What I'm saying is that, I'm kind of flustered now.
There's a difference between actively, like, hey, Matt, if you saw two crickets, would you step on them? No. The first thing was about a comparative thing, not about do you want to kill crickets? Well, would you want to kill them if you knew that you were killing the last two mating pair of a keystone species? Well, if the last two pair of a keystone mating species is sitting there underneath the wheel of my car, we're already fucked. But I'm not actively going out to try to destroy crickets. I mean, if we're down to two and somebody who knew we were down to two didn't take that step, I mean...
Well, so I think I know what you're saying. It sounds to me, so when we're talking about value and is life precious, like it, for me philosophically, my mind goes, well, which life and precious to who, and how precious? Because it's all variable. It's all subjective. Because we're the ones that are assigning the value. We're the humans. We're the ones that are assigning the value to anything. So it.
You replace those crickets under the wheel with kittens. And all of a sudden, you start getting different answers.
Yeah, it just depends on who you're asking, on when you're asking them, on what is in the problem. I mean, just
as a matter of fact, my ex-wife is pissed at me for even suggesting that we should replace those crickets with kittens, because she would save the kittens.
Yeah, I mean, but do you see what I mean? Like, it just depends.
Yeah, and I agree. I was just trying to get clarity on what Matt would consider life, and if he himself considers life to be precious.
Sorry, I'll shut up.
No. So life covers a broad range of things. I don't consider life or anything else to be intrinsically precious or to have intrinsic value, but it, to have inherent value, yes, which means that it starts off with a valuer, which is always going to be some sort of subjective assessment.
Okay. And, you know, looking at the further cosmos, you know, science is making jumps as we speak, and we've peered into the cosmos. And so far, this little speck is the only life that we know of
that we define it as life as we know it.
What percentage of the cosmos have we explored sufficiently to determine if that percentage has life?
Okay, so we have explored 100% of the observable universe.
Bullshit.
That means what we can
bullshit.
See in every direction.
Bullshit, yes. Bullshit, yeah. Bullshit. I asked, what percentage of the cosmos have we explored sufficiently to determine that there's not life there?
Oh, explore like as in go to the planet itself? I'm saying
sufficient to reach the conclusion that there's no life in what we've explored. What percentage of the cosmos fits that?
We possibly could never get to that percentage because there's life.
I asked for a percentage. What do you mean, what percentage? I didn't give you a percentage. I said, what percentage of the cosmos? You're talking about, oh, we've explored the cosmos really well and we haven't found any life other than us. Well, that's, first of all, what we found are the building blocks of life in other areas. And we've found planets that seem to be potentially life-sustaining. So of the planets that we know of that are potential to support, have the potential to support life as we would define it in carbon-based life, how many of those have we explored enough to conclude that there's not life there?
Zero.
So don't come in doing this, we're the only life we've found. We've barely scratched the surface of the cosmos.
Also, something cool that I learned from, and I'm not a biologist and I haven't.
We are the only life we have found.
So
we are the only life we have found.
And once upon a time, only knew about white swans. White swans were the only ones we'd found. Does that mean we
keep circling back? Like we're making more advances and we're discovering new things, and we might discover that there is silica-based life, there is energy-based life, there is different types of life out there that we might not perceive as life, but is life, you know, technically.
Yes, and we could also find life that's very similar to life on Earth.
Yeah, absolutely. But what I'm saying, as of right now, in this time, in this point in history, right, all of the observations that we have made, this so far is the only actual life we've
found. So what?
We might.
Here's the thing. Let's say we discovered a body, and we're going to start to investigate to determine what the cause of death was.
Sure.
At what point in the investigation would you say we're at?
Just the investigation portion, Gavin.
I'd say that we've looked at a toenail. That's a slight exaggeration. So to say that we're the only life we've found so far, when we've barely been able to look off of our planet in any sort of sense for a teeny sliver of time, you know, it's like, look at how much SETI has covered just looking for some kind of signal.
Well, the way I just recently heard it put in the sense that, like, imagine you're looking at a picture of the Earth, like just one picture, and that's what we can see of the universe. And we're trying to figure out how things are evolving from this. And it's like all we're seeing is this like snapshot in time.
Well, I think it's worse than that. I think if you actually this is a rough approximation because I haven't done the math. Somebody out there can. But I think that it would be like looking at a grain of sand or two on Earth and then concluding there's no life here. That's how much information we have about the cosmos beyond Earth when it comes to looking for life.
And I completely agree. But again, the statement still remains true that...
Okay,
you know.
Bye. I don't care. Hey, here's another true statement. What you said is fucking irrelevant. That's a true statement. It doesn't... Why would you call in to say, here's a statement that's true that doesn't edify us in any way? We're the only life we've found, and we've been looking... We're the only life we found, and we've been looking. That statement is true.
I haven't died yet.
That statement is true.
I must not ever die, because I haven't died yet.
Oh, my gosh. We are immortal. Jenna just proved it. It's frustrating. I mean, okay, there's lots of interesting things to talk about. And when it comes to, like, exploring for life in the universe and elsewhere in the cosmos, that's cool. To think that we found the building blocks of life, and we're able now at a point now where we can identify a planet that might be in the Goldilocks zone for our life, and maybe there's other life out there. Maybe it's intelligent, maybe it's not. Look, there's billions of planets orbiting billions of stars in billions of galaxies, and
it's incomprehensible. I love.
We've been to the moon. We've been to Mars. We have a couple satellites that took off and have now left our solar system, and we'll be coming back, according to Star Trek, to conquer us and other sci-fi novels. But what good is it to just say, oh, it's a true statement. We've looked around, and we're the only life we found so far. Congratulations. Look harder.
So far is the operative part of that sentence.
Yeah. And if so far was we'd explored 98% of the galaxy or the universe fairly thoroughly, that'd be impressive. But if we've just explored less than a percent of what we would need to explore to make any kind of discovery like that, you know, we're at the toenail. Mm-hmm. He definitely wasn't stabbed in the toenail. I looked at it. There's no stab wound, no bullet hole. So I'm going to conclude that he was strangled. Can't prove me wrong. And that's a true statement, too. We have Michael in Arizona. You're on with Jenna and Matt.
Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
All right.
I'm troubled by what the call screener has written down next to your name.
Yeah.
Because it says you're both a believer and not a believer.
Can you explain that?
That's not possible.
Right.
That's like saying I'm both X and not X. That's logically impossible.
Well, it seems that way.
No, it is that way.
So how do you think it is?
Okay, let's take a look at zero. Let's say you have an apple, and if you take away an apple, you said we're looking at zero.
Looking at zero.
Yeah, I know.
How do we look at zero?
If you look at not an apple, it is not there. But you would also not have a house or a car or TV because it's non-existence. Because nothing is identity.
What?
Thanks for calling. Hey, Mike in Toronto, you're a new atheist with some questions for us, so welcome.
Hi, Mike.
How are you guys doing?
I hope better.
That was quite the call the last one.
Yeah.
Well, we're not terribly new atheists. We've been atheists for a number of years. The thing is, my wife and I are very actively involved in animal rescue. We have a registered cat shelter for elderly cats.
Oh,
and that
cool.
Sort of thing. Yeah, it is very cool. But then you see things like Australia and over a billion animals died. And then all across Facebook, you see people helping the poor kangaroo or the burnt koala and all mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And it's nice to see humans doing that. But that's like the tiny sliver. You think about all those animals that are all suffering out there and, you know, they just want their homes back and they're singed and they can't sleep and all these kinds of things. And this kind of thing brings us to tears, you know. It used to be a very comforting time at one point where you would have a prayer, you know. You'd pray and you'd feel better about the whole thing. I certainly don't ever want to go back to those days. But
Why would praying to the God who created a system where fires kill kangaroos?
Well, because it makes you feel better.
But
I can see something that you could replace that with. If it was prayer that helped you before, then I could see you replacing that with so death. You're sad that these animals are dying and that hurts you, and pain can be extremely motivating. So maybe use that to see if you can do something to help, whether it's financially or if you can go and help or if you can raise awareness or raise money if you don't have it, or just use that, you know.
Yeah.
Because that can make you feel pretty good, too.
It brings you to tears.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, like literally to tears. Like, we will cry sometimes when we see these things, right?
Crying's good, too.
And I just don't know what the coping mechanism is for such a thing.
Well, first of all, crying releases endorphins. Crying itself releases endorphins and makes you feel better. That's just to start. That's actually really good for you. But then also using your emotion as a motivational object and of some sort.
Yeah, I had a feeling. I don't mean to waste you guys' time by calling in because I didn't know what you could possibly say, but
what do they do?
What do you do to cope with something like that?
I do something. I say, what can I learn from this? And I figure it out. That's ever since I became an atheist. Anytime I'm in pain, I say, okay, this is life. Shit happens. What can I do about it?
Yeah. If that's kind of my first take is, yes, there are bad things that are going to happen. What things can I do about it? What things should I do about it? And how do I prioritize where I'm spending my efforts? Does it make me sad? So I was in Australia, and kangaroos are in most areas considered just a nuisance. And so, you know, they were overpopulated and everything else. I went to a zoo and met and played with kangaroos. I saw some of them out and about, and I ate one for dinner. Now, that really pisses some people off, and I get that. And I understand that different people are going to have different perspectives on this. Does it mean that I'm not sad that there are animals? Of course I'm sad that there's animals dying. But I tend to try to take a practical approach of it, of I'm far more concerned about the humans that are dying and suffering than I am the animals. But I'm never going to fault for somebody for doing like what you do. You're doing a cat rescue thing. If I were to go to you and say, why are you doing a cat rescue for elderly cats? Why aren't you helping elderly humans who are, you know, that's just shitty, because people have different things that they're going to be passionate about and care about. I don't think you care any less for humans than you do cats just because you've decided to do this. And yet, curiously, people
will,
I actually, you know, I have two cats that died before my wife left, that are both buried out under the willow tree, and I have pictures that we painted of them. And I miss those cats, and I loved those cats. I love the other cats we had. And in the examples that I was using earlier, where I put like a hypothetical baby and a hypothetical cricket underneath the tire of the car, and I pointed out if you switched it to kittens, you're going to get different answers from people. For me, I'm still going to save the baby. But if somebody decided that they were going to be saving the kittens instead in a sort of impulsive situation like that, I don't know what I would make of that. It's not like I'm going to say, oh, you're a terrible person necessarily, because now we set up a bullshit scenario where you have to make a snap decision in an instant. Maybe you're closer to one side of the car than the other. These sorts of moral dilemmas and thought intuition pumps, as Dan Dennett calls them, but to get these sort of trolley problem things, it's not about finding what the right answer is. It's about figuring out who we are individually and collectively. And so, yeah, your real question has nothing to do with any of the shit I just said about value. It has to do with how do I deal with something that is causing me pain, and I used to be able to turn to a god, and now I can't. And for me, that is something that I approach as a practical matter as well. Because in the past, when I was a kid and when I was a believer, what did I turn to God to? And much like the caller who wanted the guardian angel, Jenna's answer there of saying you build an actual network of guardian angels. And so you have other people. You and your wife should be, you guys are doing this rescue thing together. You are feeling the same emotions and same pain over this. The two of you just feeling and sharing that together may, as unfortunate as it sounds to some people, may be the best thing that you're going to have to begin to deal with this. Mm-hmm. Other people are going to cope with it in different ways. I don't feel any need to reach out in prayer because, first of all, the question that I asked earlier of why would it be, it would not be comforting me to go to the God of the universe who created this shitty system that is doing shitty things and say, oh, please comfort me, because that wouldn't have worked for me. The fact that it did work for you means that you had a notion of a God that, you know, was where these things weren't necessarily his fault or his doing, and that he might be just as sad about it as you are. And so instead of turning to a fictional God that might be just about as sad about it as you are, you get to turn to your spouse, you get to turn to other people in the community, and you keep building the rescue that you're doing right now to do the most good you can without feeling bad that you weren't able to save everyone and everything all the time, because that we all know is impossible.
Everyone and everything will die at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah. What comes to mind—
except for Jenna. She proved that.
Not me.
What comes to mind, Matt, is how when you give the analogy of supposing You've always been told all your life that when you turn 30 years old, you're going to inherit $1 billion.
Mm. Yeah.
You get to 30 and they say, just kidding.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what it is. And when people say, you know, I talk to some theists who are like, well, what, even if it's not true, what harm does it do with our children? Well, I got to tell you, it's a lot of harm. It would have been so much better to be born and raised knowing what reality is and dealing with it than to all your life feel that you have the blessed assurance and these animals that are suffering in Australia will be in heaven one day. And then to find out, oh, just kidding, this was all bullshit.
So you know what that did for me? That basically happened to me, that experience that, oh, just kidding, this is all bullshit, basically happened to me in a moment. And that was extremely emotional for me, just like we were talking about earlier, using emotions, extremely emotional, that I had to do something, and that's what got me here.
Oh, that's cool.
That's the reason I'm here, is because I had that emotion.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So I'm volunteering and trying to do everything I can to reverse this from happening to other people.
Totally, totally.
So use it. That's like anytime somebody's suffering, how can you use it?
I think and you can take comfort in the fact that you are in fact genuinely compassionate, mm-hmm. and taking steps to try to make the world a better place in whatever way you can.
Tell yourself, I'm doing what I can, and that's all I can do.
I didn't cure cancer,
you guys are awesome.
But I saved a cat.
You're awesome too.
Thanks a lot for the call, Mike.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, guys. Bye-bye.
Somebody
calls. On that note, we're going to stop here in just a couple minutes, and then we'll do some stuff on Discord if they want to. But as stated, we have a cricket protein bar here. 16 grams of protein, 15 grams of fibers, gluten-free, lactose-free, ooh, chocolate chip cookie dough flavored.
Chocolate chip cookie dough flavored cricket bar.
Would you like to tear off a piece? Oh my gosh.
Not gonna tear.
It's like rubber.
It's like a what do you call it? I lost.
You gotta take a bigger piece than that. Here, you take that piece, I'll take this piece, and we'll save some for other people who want.
All right.
So in our little attempt to maybe do something good, Jen and I are gonna eat this thing, and because I'm not gonna be able to talk with my mouth full, you'll just have to judge from our faces what we actually think. Maybe I'll give a thumbs up. But I wanna thank whoever went and got us a cricket protein bar. The people on the other side of that wall who make the show happen. Woo! The people who showed up today and every Sunday at the Atheist Community of Austin's Free Thought Library. We're open 11 to 9, 7 days a week. You can come down, any atheist or atheist-friendly person, and you can join us for dinner. And see you next time.